I want to talk to you tonight about some things that have been misunderstood quite a little bit. You know, the trouble with religion is not that people know so little about it. It's that they know so much about it that's not so. They have been taught an awful lot that maybe is church doctrine, but you remember Christ quoted to the Pharisees of his day those terrible words from Isaiah, "In vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." And there's an awful lot that's taught today as religion that is not in the Bible. The major churches in general, you know, don't talk about the kingdom of God anymore. In fact, they don't believe in it. They believe in a sort of democracy of God. Everybody reduced to the same dead level as part of the masses, and if your doctrine is such that it's not going to bring in enough Negro or Filipino or something converts, why then rebuke God for having been too exclusive and change your doctrine to one that will bring these in. They're going to answer for that in due time, because God gave nobody authority to change his word. To restore a true perspective, those of us who have been preaching the Israel identity message have pointed out that God is no politician. He doesn't need the votes of the Negro bloc or any other bloc. He's a majority all by himself. And that he did pick his own people who were qualified by him for a specific job, chosen by him for that job, and rewarded with both duties and responsibilities as well as authority accordingly. Well, we have tried to restore a true perspective, but then some of us have swung the pendulum too far the other way. Some have been teaching that if you just are born into Israel, you just got it made automatically. It doesn't matter what your character is. You can be the worst scoundrel on earth, but that doesn't matter, because if you're an Israelite, why, you're there. You have your predestined high place in heaven all cut out for you and so forth. And that's a comforting doctrine for those who don't feel they are morally equal to living up to the responsibilities. But the Bible doesn't back it up. With all the great offers that God has made to it, has gone always the responsibility of the nation Israel and each individual Israelite to live up to this. And that's something that I want to bring about. One of the things that is so often quoted as a sweeping, all-inclusive statement is this one, a portion carefully edited out of what Paul says in the 11th chapter of Romans, Romans 11, verse 26. "And so all Israel shall be saved as it is written." Well, the punctuation's a little different, even in Paul. He says, all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Well, now, we have often enough condemned other churches for taking one verse out of context and founding a doctrine on it. And certainly we should never be guilty of that ourselves, because we know better. Now, in the first place, Paul himself is not correctly quoting Isaiah, because Isaiah didn't say all Israel shall be saved. But if you... It's Isaiah 45, verse 17, if any of you want to look it up. That's what Paul was partly quoting. But if you would just read the rest of that 11th chapter of Romans. You'll see that Paul doesn't intend any such sweeping statement as those few words lifted out of context would indicate. Note this from the 11th chapter. It's Romans 11, verses 2 to 5 and 7. Know ye not what the Scripture says of Elias, how that he maketh intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Now note what Paul goes on to say here. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. But what then? Israel has not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. Now you can't laugh off that word remainder by saying, oh well, that's all that remain, implying that the great majority are the ones who remain. Because remember now, this is taken from the Greek, and trying to find similar English words isn't the solution. You've got to see what the Greek says. There is a remnant, he said. Well, that is the Greek word lima, and it is derived from the root word lipo, which not only means a few, but which connotes lacking or insufficient in number. If you wanted to say not only a few, but not enough, that Greek word lipo is the word you would use. And lima is derived from and based on that. So this remainder is going to be a few, not 99.9% or something like that. Paul is not handing out any such doctrine. Neither did Isaiah say that they all were going to come through just because they were Israelites. Isaiah knew better. Isaiah knew the history of his people. There had been a great many times when all Israel were not saved. Let's look over a few of them. You remember when Moses was up on Mount Sinai getting the law from God. After he'd been gone some days, remember, up to this time now, Moses was the one who had performed the miracles that God gave him power to do in Egypt. Moses was the one who led them out of Egypt. Moses was the one who stood on the shore and held his staff out over the water, and the waters of the Red Sea parted and led them through. And Moses had led them along in the wilderness some little distance, and out here in desert country, Moses was the leader who always saw to it they had enough food and water. But as soon as he was gone a few days, and remember now, a lot of these people, not all of them, you remember there was a mixed multitude went with them. And that word mixed again there was the Hebrew word Arab, which means mongrel. In other words, some of them had mongrelized their race with the Egyptians while they were in Egypt. But here you have the nation of Israel, and a lot of them, and Moses gone a few days, so they went to Aaron, and they said, why, as for this fellow Moses, we don't know what's become of him. He went up the mountain there to talk to God or somebody. Now, Aaron, you make us some idol gods to lead us. After all that had happened, here they had seen every day the pillar of cloud to lead them. And at night, the pillar of fire glowing within that cloud. And yet already they wanted idol gods. Well, Aaron was, he was a good clergyman, a good representative sample. After all, you know, you don't want to be so exclusive you offend some of the congregation. So you remember Moses got gold from them, their jewelry, and cast the golden calf. Aaron, I should say. Aaron was the typical clergyman. You remember when Moses came down and called him to task for it, Aaron's excuse, I put this gold in the fire and, this calf came out. He neglected to state who made the mold in which the melted gold was cast. So, 3,000 people were killed in the penalty that came upon them for that. Plague broke out, 3,000 killed. See Exodus chapter 32. Now you remember, and this is in the 10th chapter of Leviticus, the two older sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, now they knew the instructions given as to who might approach the tabernacle and how, the instructions governing the priests. But they were ready to take over and do it their way. They offered incense and strange fire, as the Bible calls it, and they were slain by God. Now you can't say that Nadab and Abihu were part of this mongrel mixed multitude. They were the two oldest sons of Aaron, so there was pure Israel stock. And they weren't saved, were they? Well, in Numbers, the 11th chapter, verses 1 and 2. Now this was rough going, this travel through the desert. There were some hardships. And you remember the people began complaining about it. They said, we wish we'd stayed in Egypt and been slaves there. At least we ate well there. Now what were they doing? Here was rebellion against what God had told them to do. Sure, they were Israelites, but he gave them a job to do, and he gave them a tough job. And they weren't equal to it. They were ready to quit. So you read this. And when the people complained, it displeased Yahweh. And Yahweh heard it, and his anger was kindled. And the fire of Yahweh burnt among them, and consumed them that were in the outermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto Yahweh, the fire was quenched. So, here were some Israelites, not saved. Well, they still grumbled about their food in this same 11th chapter of Numbers. Now, God had promised them through Moses that they would have plenty to eat. And they were complaining that this manna, they didn't like this, they wanted meat. He said, I'll give you meat till it's running out of your nostrils. So, he sent them quail, more than they could eat. But with it, you notice, he also sent a great plague, which killed a great many of them. All this in the 11th chapter of Numbers. Well, finally, after their 40 years, this was before the 40 years wandering, they had gotten to the point where they were ready to turn north into Palestine. And you remember they sent out a group of spies to look the land over and see how they should go into it to occupy it. And they came back, And only two men out of the batch said, God promised it to us, and that's sufficient. We can conquer it if he says to go in there. And all the rest, oh, they said it's a wonderful land. We never saw anything with fields so productive. But all these people here, here are the giants. We can't go in. Here are all these big fortified cities. And the people were not willing to go. That's Numbers chapters 13 and 14. So when the people rebelled, only three wanted to go ahead, Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. So all the rest of them were condemned to wander out there in the desert until they died. God said, not a one of this generation which has rebelled are going to enter that land, set foot in it. Your children will, because I promised it to them, but you who have doubted my word and refused to obey me, not for you. All Israel saved? No. All but three of them died in the desert. Well, in the 16th chapter of Numbers, Korah, who was a Levite, he led a rebellion. He was ambitious. He wanted to take over the place that Moses and Aaron had, leading the people. You remember he, before the whole assembly, he said to Moses and Aaron, he said, you take too much upon yourselves, setting yourself up above the people like this. And he said, we're all as holy as you and all fit to be priests. So you remember Moses said, all right, tomorrow you, Korah, and those who follow you, you come here with your little metal censers in which you have fire and incense, and Aaron and his sons will be here with theirs, and you can each offer incense before the tabernacle of God, and let's see who God accepts. Well, you know what happened to it. Korah and his accomplices, the leaders of them, were swallowed up by the earth. It split open, they fell into the crevice, and it closed upon them. And the rest were killed by fire from Yahweh. Now there were a lot of the people who didn't reject this rebellion. They were just, you know, they were middle of the roaders. They were going to wait and see what happened. If Korah had gotten away with it, they'd have followed him. They didn't take an active part in the rebellion. They didn't have courage enough to be on either side. So plague broke out among them, and 14,700 of them died of the plague. Now remember, this was no mere accident. This was a punishment sent by God. All Israel saved? No. You can't show me any time in the history of Israel when all Israel were saved. Well, you could go on with many other examples. There were plenty of them died in the wars with Assyria and Babylon. Plenty of them killed in their fighting with the Philistines and so on. Now, as we know, God can bring his own followers safely through danger. So when great numbers of them were slaughtered on those occasions, you know they had it coming to them. Sure, they were born Israelites, but they weren't living up to it. So we can't let ourselves be carried away by the idea that all we need to do is just be born. We've got to do more than that. We've got to live. Now, you have a bigger opportunity open to you than anybody who is not of God's people Israel. No question of that. But you've got to take your active part in getting it. On this business of a remnant coming through, it's interesting to look up the words that are used in the original languages. Let's go back to the 10th chapter of Isaiah, verses 20 to 23. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. Now that word remnant there, she'or, it means a remainder. Then this goes on. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. And again, it's that word she'or. Now, here is what you find quoted in the New Testament at times. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. Now that word translated consumption is the Hebrew word kilayon, and it means destruction. The destruction decreed shall overflow with righteousness. For Yahweh, God of hosts, shall make a consumption, and here it's a little different word, it's kolal. And its meaning really is to consume completely. It's more emphatic than just merely destruction. For Yahweh, God of hosts, shall make a destruction even determined in the midst of all the land. So now, in Romans 10, Paul refers back to that. Isaiah also cries concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. Now that word remnant, we're getting into the Greek here with Paul, you see, because these were Greek manuscripts translated from. It's katalema, which means a few. You can't paraphrase that into, oh, everybody that remains, a few shall be saved. Then Isaiah 46, verses 3 and 4. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb, even to your old age, I am he, and even the white hairs will I carry you. I have made, and I will bear, and even I will carry and will deliver you. Now that all the remnant, that's she'arif, which means that which has escaped. Now when an army is routed, those that manage to escape with their lives generally are few and disorganized, you'll note. Again, Zephaniah 3, verse 13. The remnant, again that word she'arif, the remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth. For they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Now that's where you get your remnant. Those that are not deceitful. Can you trust all of our people today? You know you can't. And that is why not all are going to be saved. Again, Jeremiah 31, verse 7. For thus saith Yahweh, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations. Publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Yahweh, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. And again, it's that she'arif. Those who have escaped. Then Joel 12, verse 32. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of Yahweh shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as Yahweh hath said, and in the remnant whom Yahweh shall call. And that now is the word sarid, a survivor. You know, we got a nation of 200 million people here. And if 1,500 die of an epidemic of Asian flu, you don't speak of all the rest of the 200 million as survivors. It's when most of them are swept away and a few are left that you refer to them as survivors. So the lesson that goes with this is that special privileges bring special responsibilities. Rewards beyond anything we can imagine if we live up to it. But don't ever think you can dodge your responsibility. You remember what Joshua said to the people of the 2.5 tribes who wanted to take their land east of the Jordan. He said, if you plan just to stay here and not go on as part of the army to help conquer the rest of the land west of the Jordan as God told you to. If you do that, you are sinning against God, and be sure that your sin will find you out. So always, this responsibility has to be met. Well, what about all Israel? You can divide all Israel into three classes. One class are the hopelessly wicked, and you've got plenty of them today, as we've had in every generation we've had a record of. And they've been periodically destroyed for their wickedness. Not saved, destroyed. Then you've got on the other extreme the relatively good remnant. And then in between you've got the great mass. They're generally not extremely bad, and they never are extremely good. They're kind of halfway between. And what about them? It's easy enough to classify the two extremes and see what's going to happen to them. Well, now, the evil group are among us. Why? Simply because we, the rest of the nation of Israel, are violating God's commandment that we should destroy those people out of our midst. You go back and look where the various commandments of the law are given through Moses. You will find after one and another of the sins listed there that the person doing that shall be put to death. So all Israel shall see and fear and shall no more commit such sin. Do we do it? No. We never have done it more than haphazardly, and these people have multiplied among us. And now you find on the part of public figures, such as our Attorney General of the State of California and the Attorney General of the United States of America, who are practically saying that even imprisoning them is a wrongful injustice against somebody who merely robbed and raped and murdered because it's all society's fault that he chose to behave that way. Well, the wicked are here because we've allowed them to be. One of my radio broadcasts, I used the title The Mystery of Good and Evil. People have said, why is it that God allows evil to exist? Well, the answer is given in the Bible. He allows it to exist because you allow it to exist. You were not put here to be passive spectators in a drama worked out by somebody else. You, of all people, were put here to be the active participants in this thing, to bring about the kingdom of God on earth. And so few of our people have been willing to recognize that responsibility that they've never had the numbers, the authority, the power to do it. So the nation as a whole has had to pay the penalty. Well, some of you were wondering now, what can I do? Here I've told you about all this responsibility. Now, what's expected of you? Great things? Are you to change the course of history and make nations behave and all this sort of thing, big spectacular things? No. Only in a very few of these many generations has anybody reached that point. But God has a way of bringing about His purposes through people that don't seem to be outstanding. And yet just the same, in their own quiet way, they're doing the thing that He put them here to do. And those are the people who are the real elect of Israel. I've told you before how in the Hebrew different words are used with very different meanings, which have been lost by inaccurate translation into English. When the entire nation of Israel was spoken of, the Hebrew word used was Adah. But when the select leadership group, the ones upon whom God could rely, those who had the spiritual capacity to respond to him, when those were spoken of, a very different Hebrew word, Kahal, was used. Now in your King James Version, both Adah and Kahal are translated sometimes congregation, sometimes assembly, with no consistency, no attempt to preserve a distinction between them, and no comprehension on the part of the translators that there was any distinction. Now you people are part of that Kahal, but what sort of things can you do? Well, I want to point out that God has used the most insignificant of people to accomplish some pretty great things. About 892 B.C., the Assyrian king Ben-Hadad, with an enormous army, besieged the city of Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. And he stayed there, besieging it, until there was extreme famine in the city. They were at the point of starvation. All food they had was used up. And the Syrian army was so enormously greater than the army of Israel cooped up in Samaria that they didn't dare go out and meet them in battle. Now the prophet Elisha was there in that city. This is in the 7th chapter of 2 Kings. So here they were now, surrounded by this enormous army. The army outside, they could live off the country. Their foraging parties were going out wherever food existed and scooping it up and bringing it in. They weren't short of anything. It was only the people in the city that were reduced to starvation. So Elisha said this, "Thus saith Yahweh, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria." Well, that measure was about 2 quarts, and you couldn't have bought a measure of flour for 10,000 shekels in this besieged and starving city. "So tomorrow about this time, a measure of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Then a lord on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, 'Behold, if Yahweh would make windows in heaven, could this thing be?' And Elisha said, 'Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof.'" You know, when you challenge God in that way, you've taken on yourself a big contest, and you're apt to lose it. "And there were 4 lepers at the entering in of the gate." Now, from the earliest dawn of history, leprosy has been regarded with a special horror. No cure for it was known. Of all diseases, it's the most spectacular. You literally rot away as you live. You reach the point where joints of your fingers rot and fall off because the disease has destroyed the circulation system. And while you're living, bit by bit, your body dies and falls apart. A spectacularly horrible thing. Anyone who got leprosy was driven out. He couldn't enter into the city or into a camp. He had to live on the outside. He couldn't engage in commerce. Nobody would buy anything that he had touched for fear the plague would be carried with it. From a safe distance, they might toss him a coin. That was what was left to him of his life. And there were four lepers at the entering into the gate. And they said to one another, "Why sit we here until we die? If we say we will enter into the city, then the famine is in the city. And if we sit here, we die also. Now therefore come, and let us fall into the host of the Syrians. If they save us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die." And they rose up in the twilight to go unto the camp of the Syrians. And when they were come to the outermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. For Yahweh had made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great army. And they said one to another, "Lo, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the king of the Egyptians to come upon us." Whereupon they arose and fled in the twilight. They left their tents, their horses, their asses, even the camp as it was, and fled for their life. And when these lepers came to the outermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and did eat and drink, and carried away thence silver and gold and raiment, and hid it. Then they said one to another, "We are not doing well. This is a day of good tidings, and do we hold our peace? If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come, that we may go and tell the king's household." So they went to the gate of the besieged city, and they had a tough time getting the guards to let them in. And this was terrific news. "Take us to the king." Well, finally they were taken to the king, and the king of Israel wouldn't believe it. As long as it was daylight, he could see out there a few hundred yards away the camp of all these Syrians. And now, a little before midnight, in come these lepers and say that whole army has disappeared. He wasn't going to fall for such a trap. Finally, they persuaded him to send two scouts out to go to the camp and see whether this was true or not. And they found that it was just as the lepers reported. The Syrians had fled in such panic they left their food and weapons and everything behind. Here was a deserted camp. Now, you remember this nobleman who sneered at this. "Why, could God do this, even if he opened the windows of heaven to drop this down to us?" Morning came, and the people prepared to rush out to the camp of the Syrians, because here was food, and everybody was hungry. It had been weeks since anybody had had a good meal, and it had been several days since most of them had had any food at all. And here was a wild mob ready to storm out. And this nobleman who had sneered at the idea, here he was at the gate. And the moment the gate swung open, out came this terrific rush of people and trampled him to death. He saw the coming of it, but he didn't get to eat of it. Now, who could you have found in all the nation of Israel more insignificant than these four lepers? They were not important landholders and farmers. They were not businessmen. They weren't bankers. They weren't statesmen. Just four poor outcast lepers. And with them, God saved the kingdom. in a few days, those starving people would have had to open the gates and let the Syrian army come in. So, God chose those people to save the kingdom of Israel. You know, you've had examples of this before. Because of their apostasy, God allowed the 12 tribe nation of Israel to be conquered and ruled by the kingdom of Midian for 7 years. And they were pretty roughly treated. Then God commissioned Gideon to save Israel. Well, now, Gideon, he said, "Who am I that I should save Israel? My father's family is unimportant in one of the small tribes, and I'm the least of my family." He was doubtful about this. So you remember, he asked for a sign as a test, whether this was true. He said, "I'm going to leave a sheep's fleece out overnight, and if this thing is really true, tomorrow morning let there be dew on the fleece, but none on the ground around it." Tomorrow morning, that's the way it was, dew on the fleece, no place else. Well, Gideon was a skeptic. He said, "Please give me one more try at this. Tomorrow morning, let there be dew on the ground all around and none on the fleece." God was patient. He'd picked Gideon to do this job. He knew how astonished Gideon was because it was a job Gideon couldn't do. Gideon didn't realize that God was going to do the job himself, and he just picked Gideon to get the credit for it. So the second day, Gideon got the sign he'd asked. So then he had the courage to come out to lead them. He gathered together an army of 32,000 men. And you read, "And Yahweh said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianite into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me." So God told him to send all the cowards home. Anybody was really afraid to go into battle. And 22,000 out of the 32,000 went home. You know, this business of getting up a volunteer army isn't as easy as it looks. They had to have draft laws in those days, too. Well, here were 10,000. God said to Gideon, "That's still too many." He said, "Take them down to the creek for a drink. Some will bend down and lap up the water directly from the creek. Some will scoop it up in their hands and drink out of their hands." Now, the ones that lap the water up directly out of the creek, those are going to be your army. And there were only 300 out of the 10,000 that did. God said, "Send the other 9,700 home." Now here was a nation, the Midianites, militarily powerful enough to have conquered and ruled for 7 years the entire nation of Israel. And God said, 300 men are all you take out into battle. Well, you know what Gideon was told to do. The Midianites were camped, a huge camp out there. Now Gideon still had some misgivings. He was worried when he had 32,000 men. Now he had 300. And here were scores of thousands of soldiers out in the camp of Midian. God said, "Well, if you still have doubts, you sneak down in the darkness till you come to the edge of the camp and see what you observe." So he sneaked up within hearing distance of one of the tents, and some of the soldiers of the Midianites were talking there. And one of them said, "I had the strangest dream I saw, have you ever seen any of this Near East bread? It's an unleavened bread baked in usually round, big flat sheets. He said, I saw a loaf of barley bread come rolling down the hill into this camp, and it knocked down tents right and left. It was just smashing the whole camp. And the other soldier said, that's an omen from God. That barley loaf, that represents Gideon and his men. It shows we're going to be defeated. Well, the other things hadn't quite convinced Gideon, but this did. He went back and got his 300 men. God said, all right, here's what you do. Each of your 300 men is to take a lamp. Now, you've seen pictures of the lamps they had in those days. It looked like a rather flat and shallow teapot. It had a little handle on one end, had that central pot where there was oil, and the spout of the teapot. There was a cloth wick going down in that, a bit of cord, which soaked up oil, and then you lit the end of it. They were small things, about so big. So God said, each of your men shall have a lamp. Light it. Then you get an earthenware pot, and you put the lamp down in the bottom of that pot so that the light of it can't be seen, until you 300 men can surround about three sides of the camp of Midian. You sneak up on them in the darkness. And then suddenly, when you give the signal, Gideon, every man will smash this earthenware pot so that all at once the Assyrians see this circle of lights around them, and every man shout, the sword of Yahweh and of Gideon. Startling thing to be awakened out of your sleep that way, isn't it? After you've already been told that your dream was that you were going to be defeated. That did startle these Midianites. In their panic, they jumped up. They didn't know whether the army of Gideon was already among them. Here it was dark in the camp. So whoever found another man scurrying around near him, supposed it was an enemy, and he slashed at him with his sword. The Midianites killed about half of their own force that way, and the rest fled in panic. So, it didn't take the leader of an enormous army. It didn't take a statesman. It didn't take a man of importance. Here was a man who wasn't even among the important members of his own family. But God said, you go out and do your job, and I'll see what the results are to be. I'm taking care of that end of it. Moffat's translation of 1 Samuel 14, verse 6 is especially good and clear. The Eternal never has any difficulty about delivering his people by means of many or by means of few. So as far as the leadership group, the Kahal, is concerned, you aren't being required to do great and heroic things ordinarily. That's not the way God usually does it. Your job is to live up to your ideals. Your job is to be somebody God can depend upon to be faithful to him, someone he can depend upon to see that these ideals are not lost before the next generation comes along. Well, what about the great mass of people? You couldn't interest them. You could talk about this day and night for the rest of your lives, and if you could compel them to stay and listen to you, you wouldn't make any converts. Born Israelites, too. What's their part in this thing? Well, Their part is that it took a nation to demonstrate what God wanted to have proved here on earth. You know, if God had sent an angel or a few angels down here to live in perfect personal conduct and to use their tremendous angelic powers to put down trouble wherever it came in the world, what would he have proved? For most of humanity, nothing. He would have proved that angels are a different order of being from ourselves, that they have different powers and capacities, and they can get results we can't. And as far as people are concerned, it wouldn't prove anything to them. Well, suppose that God took just the elect, those that in the Old Testament he calls the Kahal. He didn't bother producing any other people in Israel. Well, it would prove that God had a few favorites. It would prove that he took good care of them. It would prove that he rewarded them highly. But for the ordinary run-of-the-mill sort of person, he would say, well, what does that prove about me? I'm not one of them. I'm not able to do what they can do. I don't get special favors from God. What have you proved? For him, you wouldn't have proved anything. There had to be a nation in which the ordinary dumb guy could live better than other nations. Not because he had brains enough to bring it about, because they never have had, but because he at least had good sense enough to follow those few who constitute God's elect, the Kahal, and be led into obedience to God's law. That's what the nation was for. The people of Israel, remember how often in the Old Testament, especially Isaiah, God says, ye are my witnesses, when he's speaking to the nation of Israel. We need to be his witnesses to the world that if the nation would live according to God's rules, and it always took the policeman's club and the executioner's sword to keep them living that way. But if the nation would live according to these rules, then you would demonstrate to the world that here was a nation which had prosperity such as no other nation was ever able to achieve. Here was a nation which was not afflicted by the plagues that came upon the other. They had good health. They had long life. Here was a nation which had liberty such as none of the others had. Some one of our famous statesmen, probably Benjamin Franklin, said, if a people will not be ruled by God, they will certainly be ruled by tyrants. And that's the lesson that the world has had to learn. The laws of God give the greatest freedom that any nation can ever have. So that's why the great mass of people, all Israel, were put here. They were put here with the responsibility to do what they were told with regard to obeying the laws of God. And when they hadn't lived up to it, when they became an obstruction instead of a tool in the hand of God to accomplish his purposes, they weren't saved. They were put out of the way. Scores of thousands of them at a time, over and over and over again. With God's favor goes the tremendous responsibility of living up to it. When you're selected for this sort of a job, you may never have the opportunity to do the great heroic things that are recorded in history. But remember now those four lepers. Not a one of them led an army. Not a one of them routed that big besieging force of Syrians. Not a one of them led a rescue force to bring food into the city. All they did was go out to the camp of the Syrians, find it empty, and go back and report what they had seen. The least of all the people around, and what appeared like the least spectacular job of all, and yet they saved the kingdom, as far as any human being accomplished the saving of it. So whatever your particular walk of life is, as I say, you have the responsibility of showing the good character that God requires of those who are his favorites. You can't lie to people. You can't cheat them. You can't live a wicked life without paying a higher penalty than the ordinary run-of-the-mill who were never called upon to be anything but just part of a mob. But that isn't too much to ask of you. If you lead the sort of life where you are demonstrating the way God meant people to live, you're loyal to him, you are trying to learn what his will is and to conform to it. You don't have to do these big historic things. Your part's a small one, but it's an important one, because God generally accomplishes his purpose through the little people. You know, the ones like Napoleon and figures like that who say, I led the army and I conquered this nation and so on, they're not working for the glory of God. Each is working merely for his own personal glory. And that's why God hardly ever leaves anything like that up to them. He does his work through the little person like those of us here, because we're not trying to be the important one. We realize the importance is God's. So, don't let anybody kid you that merely being born into Israel in and of itself is all it takes to be saved. You can take one verse out of context, but you go back to the Bible and see where it fits in and what it's based on, and it doesn't uphold any such idea. Those in Israel who have been saved have been the faithful ones. And at times when the bulk of the nation were that way, the nation had peace and prosperity, everything good. And sometimes there were only a few. You remember when Elijah came back to try to save Israel from Ahab, there were just 7,000 men left in the whole nation of Israel who had not become apostate idolaters, worshiping Baal. That's how few there were. But God saved the nation because of them. You remember when he came down to destroy the city of Sodom, and he told Abraham about it, and Abraham was worried because his nephew Lot and Lot's family lived in Sodom. And you remember how worried Abraham was? Well, he said, yeah, it's a pretty good-sized city, and they're mostly bad, but, well, there might be 50 good people in Sodom. Would you destroy the whole city, including these 50 good people, because the others were bad? God said, no, if there's 50 there, I'll spare it. And you remember how Abraham wanted to drive kind of a hard bargain. Sometimes God's surprisingly patient. He kept saying, well, perhaps there's 40 or 30 or 20. Finally, God said, you know, if I can find even 10 good people in Sodom, I won't destroy it for the sake of the 10. Well, there weren't 10 in Lot's family, and the rest of them weren't worth saving. In fact, not all of Lot's family, you remember. So the city had to go. God took care of those who didn't merit the destruction. But always it is the few on whom he relies, the few who have measured up to the test of character. You're not going to be judged by big things. I forget who it was who said, when you stand before God's judgment seat, he's not going to look you over for medals or diplomas, but for scars. Have you been out there in the battle for right? And that's always a tough one. You're having to take an awful lot more than you can dish out. But have you stood fast for the good things? If you have, that part of Israel is going to be saved. Not only saved, but put right up on the top. You're going to be the icing up on top of the top layer of the cake. It's worth working for.
This tape was produced by Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé. We have much more information in written form and tape recordings, both reel and cassette. We offer this material to assist the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken Yahweh's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. Feel free to call upon us for personal consultation. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of the kingdom. Many people are meeting in their homes using Pastor Comparé's material as the basis for their study. Such groups represent a healthy return to the early assemblies of believers and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian church system a place to worship with other believers. We would hope that such meetings would also provide the nucleus of support for our radio broadcast in your area, and we shall be happy to cooperate with you in this regard. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay the expenses of spreading the gospel. We try to merit your support. Please send your letters, your requests for material, and your generous contributions to Your Heritage, P.O. Box 5486, San Diego, California, ZIP 92105. Goodbye, and may the grace of Jesus Christ be with you all.